As we dig into the book of Ruth tonight, just to remind us, we're going into the chapter 4 here. And the book of Ruth is really not a book about Ruth. It's much more about Naomi. It's much more about what God is doing in her heart. And as Naomi and her husband Elimelech left Bethlehem in Ruth 1, they journeyed out what they thought was going to be for a short time, but they ended up staying away from Bethlehem for years. Elimelech and their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. And as they went out from Bethlehem because of a famine, they went to the land of Moab. And we talked about how that was not God's will for the Israelites to leave the land when they were under some judgment, chastisement, because of disobedience. But they went and fled somewhere else. And while they were in Moab, Elimelech died. Naomi's sons, Mahlon and Chilion, married women there in Moab, Moabites, Orpah and Ruth. And while they were there, both of her sons died. And it was at that point of bereavement that she encouraged her daughters to stay there in Moab. And she was going to go back to Bethlehem because she heard the Lord had prospered them. And they again had food in the land of Bethlehem. But Ruth wouldn't leave her. Ruth made that vow of family and love to Naomi. And Naomi's heart, even with that expression of love, was not changed. She came back bitter to Bethlehem. But in chapter 2, we saw that Naomi observed that God still cared about her, cared about Ruth, as Boaz showed Ruth kindness to allow her to glean in his field. And when she saw what was happening and that it wasn't chance, it was the hand of God, her heart started to spiritually awaken again because of God's expression of mercy. In the last chapter, chapter 3, we called Cold Feet, we see that Naomi counseled Ruth to go to Boaz and ask him to be the kinsman redeemer for their family. And Boaz was willing to do that. And here in chapter 4, we read what happens because Naomi told Ruth, when Ruth came back and Boaz had accepted that offer, Naomi said, "Don't worry, this guy is not going to rest until he has resolved this matter." And remember, when Boaz made the commitment to Ruth, it wasn't necessarily that he would be the kinsman redeemer, because there was one nearer in relation to Elimelech than Boaz. But Boaz was saying, "If he won't, I will. One way or another, we will make sure you are taken care of." So here in chapter 4, we're going to read the first 10 verses and talk about being at the gate. The title of the message this evening is Boaz and Mr. So-and-so. Verse 1, "Then went Boaz up to the gate and sat him down there. And behold, the kinsman of whom Boaz spake came by, unto whom he said, 'Ho, such a one, turn aside, sit down here.' And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, 'Sit ye down here.' And they sat down. And he said unto the kinsman, 'Naomi, that is come again out of the country of Moab, selleth a parcel of land, which was our brother Elimelech's. And I thought to advertise thee, saying, buy it before the inhabitants and before the elders of my people. If thou wilt redeem it, redeem it. But if thou wilt not redeem it, then tell me, that I may know, for there is none to redeem it besides thee, and I am after thee.' And he said," this nearer relative said, "I will redeem it. Then said Boaz, 'What day thou buyest the field of the hand of Naomi, thou must buy it also of Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead among his inheritance.' And the kinsman said, 'I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I mar mine own inheritance. Redeem thou my right to thyself, for I cannot redeem it.' Now this was the manner in former time in Israel concerning redeeming and concerning changing. For to confirm all things, a man plucked off his shoe and gave it to his neighbor, and this was a testimony in Israel. Therefore the kinsman said unto Boaz, 'Buy it for thee.'" So he drew off his shoe, gave it to Boaz. And Boaz said unto the elders and unto all the people, "Your witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's of the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, have I purchased to be my wife, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance, that the name of the dead be not cut off from among his brethren, and from the gate of his place ye are witnesses this day." And we'll stop there at this point. To conduct this business, Boaz goes to the gate. We kind of need to lay a little bit of background before we get into some of the meat of this. The gate was the most significant place in a community like that. Kind of like the square here in Huntingdon. Four reasons it was so significant. Number one, the traffic. The gate was the way you got in and out of the city. And if you wait there long enough, you're going to see whoever it is you're looking for, because they're not going to leave the city unless they go through the gate, right? And they're not going to come into the city unless they go in through the gate. So you're looking for somebody, have a seat, wait. They'll be there eventually. So that's where Boaz went to find this other person. He knew they would go in or out the gate that morning. Number two, it was used for transactions. With all the people coming in or out, it was a great place to buy and sell and also gather witnesses for legal transactions, kind of like this. That's exactly what Boaz did. There were people sitting around there, and he gathered 10 of the elders, the older men of the city, to be a witness to this transaction. It would also be a place where they would have proceedings. If there was a legal matter that needed to be addressed in the community, the elders who were sitting at the gate would be available for legal matters for the community. Kind of like you got some people who liked to just sit outside Walmart. Kind of, you know, people coming in and out. But you're usually not gathering them to be witnesses for legal transactions. But back in the day, that's what you would do there. They were there and available for all sorts of matters. And finally, the gate was important because of protection. It was a walled city, and it was walled for a reason. And they had a gate for a reason, and it was meant to protect the city. And so it was a very, very, very important place. Kind of the heart of the city was not in the middle. It was at the gate of that place. And so that's exactly where Boaz went. That's where he found the man. That's where he found the witnesses he would need. That's the place that this business was conducted. The first matter that Boaz brings to this other man is the land. Land. Land was a big deal. It was one of the most significant possessions of these people. Three reasons. Number one, in an agricultural society, land meant income. It's where they raised their crops. It's where they grazed their sheep or their cows, whatever. It happened on the land. And so for most of these people, land meant a source of income, prosperity, provision for their family. Number two, it was also their identity. When they came into the land, God gave them the land. He said, "This is the land I'm giving you." And the Lord had that land all divided up among the tribes based upon their size. And lots were cast and lines were drawn. And certain parcels of land were given to different families. And there was a history of overcoming the enemies who lived in that land and taking it over little by little so that they got their spot, they got their plot, they built those things. The land was identified by their families. And so it was part of who they were. The names of the cities were often names of people who had lived in those places. It was their family place, so to speak. And so the land was a big part of who they were, not only at the present, but in the future, because finally the land was the inheritance. It's what they left their kids. They took that land. They conquered it from the enemies that were there, or they tried to. They tended it. They allowed it to become prosperous. They built homes and farms, sometimes towns, villages, all these things there. They built it so that they could provide a legacy to their children. And so land was really, really important to these people, because everybody wanted to be respected right now. And those who held land and those who were able to produce crops, able to produce livestock and to work the land successfully would be respected. They would be successful. But it's also part of how they would be remembered in the future. It was going to be part of their legacy. There were things named after people and things that had happened in that. And so that land wasn't just about being prosperous today. It was about being remembered in the future. And so when it came to Elimelech, who had died, there were a couple of matters that Boaz brought up that needed to be addressed. The first was the land. And the second was his legacy. Because what good would the land be if there were no descendants of Elimelech to live upon the land? And so he broke these issues apart. It's very likely, because of the mention of needing to redeem this from Naomi, it's really, I think, kind of more of a for Naomi. It's very likely that before Elimelech and his family left Bethlehem to go to Moab, they sold their land to someone for money, perhaps to go and get a start in Moab and try to be prosperous with the thought that they would come back eventually and buy it back. That happened back then. There was this right they had because of the way God had set things up in Israel, that if someone lost their land or had to sell their land, there would be opportunities for them or a near kinsman to redeem that land so it could stay in the family because it was so important, part of who they were. And so what Boaz seems to be bringing up here is who has the right to redeem this land. First and foremost, we have land that belonged to Elimelech. It was in the family. You're the closest relative to him. I'm next in line. Who is going to have the legal right to go and redeem this land and buy this land so it stays in the family? And so when Boaz went to the gate and he had both of these items to deal with, the land and the legacy, he waits there and he finds that guy. And when he sees them, he says here in the King James, it says, "Ho!" Or like, "Hey, such a one. Such a one. Such a one." In the Hebrew, it's one of those phrases that's difficult to translate. Depending on what version you're looking at, some people translate it as friend. That's not exactly what it means. It's an idiom, kind of like when we say it's raining cats and dogs. We know cats and dogs are not literally falling from the sky. We know we mean by that that it's raining really hard. Okay? The Hebrew has an idiom here that's difficult to translate because it doesn't necessarily make sense when you put it into English. And so some interpretations have been used to try to say what this means. But the best equivalent of this, of what the Hebrew is trying to express, is the phrase so-and-so. So-and-so. So-and-so is a phrase that we use when you don't need to specify the individual or you don't know their name. Or you don't remember their name, you say, "Oh, so-and-so did this or did that." And that's the sense of what the Hebrew is trying to express, is that this near kinsman is referred to in a sense as so-and-so. And as the nearest kinsman to Elimelech, he had the first right to buy back the land. First dibs belonged to this guy because he was more closely related to Elimelech than Boaz was. And upon the initial presentation of the facts, the first part about the land, he was very clear. Verse 4, he said, "I will redeem it." You see it right there. Mr. So-and-so said, "I will redeem it." Now, based on what Mr. So-and-so knew thus far, the only thing that he had to worry about was the land. What was going to happen? He would have the opportunity to buy this land. Elimelech had no heir on this land, so Elimelech's land would become his land. So now he has more land than he ever had before. And his children, assuming that he has children, it's kind of implied that he does because he talks about his inheritance later. His children would then have the inheritance of this land, so they would become larger landowners. Opportunity for more income, more inheritance, more legacy. This sounds great. Yes, I'll take the land. Yes, I will redeem it. But there's that other part. So once he said, oh yeah, I'll do this. Boaz said, okay, the same day you buy the field, you also have to fulfill the responsibility toward Ruth, the widow. Naomi was past the childbearing years, it seems to be at this point. But Ruth was not. And there was an opportunity through Ruth, the widow of one of Elimelech's children, that an heir, so to speak, could be raised up under the name of Elimelech, so that Elimelech's name could remain tied to the land, that there could be a memory of him in the community, that that heir would take on that land. And the responsibility now, when you add Ruth to the equation, is first to buy the land from its current owner and work it to make it prosperous. So that was already a given, and he was willing to do that. But with this additional information about the legacy, he also would have to try to father a child, preferably a son in this culture, with Ruth, and to treat her as a wife. Okay, so that's become more complicated now, because he would have to try to have another child and treat Ruth as a wife. And there's this whole business of Naomi. Because this was tied to Elimelech, there would also be a responsibility to provide for her because she was Ruth's mother-in-law. So there's now another mouth to feed, two mouths to feed, and hopefully a potential child to take care of. And that this child, if to have this child would inherit that land someday. That child that would be born of Ruth would inherit that land, but that child would also be one of his children. And so any land that that man had would have to be divided up amongst his existing children, any future children he had, plus this other child with Ruth. That child would get a share of his inheritance as well that he already had, as well as the land of Elimelech. And so, in short, when it was just the land, that looked really attractive to him. But when it was not just the land, it was also the legacy. His concern, and he says it right here in verse 6, he goes, I can't do that, lest I mar mine own inheritance. You do it. I can't redeem it. What was his concern? His concern was it endangering his own legacy. What he planned to leave his children. How he had planned to preserve his name and his reputation in that community. This transaction would mar what he expected and had planned to happen, what he wanted to happen. So when he heard about not only the land, but the responsibility to raise up a legacy, that it could happen through Ruth, he was out. He was not interested. He said, I cannot redeem it. He had said in verse 4, I will. And now in verse 6, he says, I cannot redeem it. And so when this man made that statement, he wouldn't. It then fell to Boaz. Not only could he, that other man could have too, but he wouldn't. But Boaz could in this new development, and he would. And so he made a transaction. And it tells us here, it's interesting. I think all these things are here for a purpose. And it tells us here in verses 7 and 8. And there's a really good point here. And I'm going to go back and talk more about Mr. So-and-so in a minute here. But I want to look at verses 7 and 8 for a moment. It tells us how this transaction took place. It tells us that when, at this time in Israel, at the time when Boaz came to redeem the land and the legacy of Elimelech, that the way that they conducted a business transaction was that the one who was giving up that right would remove their sandal and give it to his neighbor as a testimony, kind of as a symbol of what had happened. You know, before the days of being able to sign documents and keep them all nicely in file, you know, and scan all those things, what you do is you would get a guy's sandal when you'd have a transaction like that. And so someone who is a big businessman at that time would probably have to build a bigger closet to hold all these sandals that they would be collecting. I don't know exactly how that would work, but that's part of what they did. And, you know, apparently, you know, you knew whose sandals was whose and all those kinds of things. Different time, different culture. But what's interesting about that little detail, go with me back to Deuteronomy chapter 25. Go with me back to Deuteronomy chapter 25. There's a really neat little lesson here that I saw as I was looking through this again. Deuteronomy 25, starting in verse 5, it tells us here about the responsibilities of a kinsman redeemer. It says, if brethren dwell together, starting in verse 5, and one of them die and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without or outside the family unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn which she beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother which is dead, that his name be not put out of Israel. That's all we've been talking about, right? And if the man like not to take his brother's wife, so if the man's not willing to take up the relationship, to take up that wife of his brother or near kinsman in this case that died, then let the brother's wife go up to the gate unto the elders and say, so again, this is in front of the elders, go to the gate. Okay, we're at the gate. Go to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up unto his brother a name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak unto him. And if he stand to it and says, I like not to take her, then shall his brother's wife come unto him in the presence of the elders and loose his shoe from off his foot and spit in his face and shall answer and say, so shall it be done unto the man that will not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel the house of him that hath his shoe loosed. I don't want to be called that, do you? Now, it's kind of funny. No doubt in the Hebrew, and when they heard it, it was much more, you know, ominous sounding. But that's what the Lord prescribed. That's how this was supposed to happen when someone would not fulfill the responsibility of a kinsman redeemer. This was a big deal. And either Ruth or Naomi would have the right to go to the gate where Boaz was and make this confrontation to this man. And if he's like, I'm not going to do it, she would have the right and responsibility to pull off his sandal, spit in his face, and say, may this be done unto you. And then that guy's going to have a bad reputation. That's not what happened here. That's not what happened here when we read the book of Ruth. It was much more, shall we say, civilized seeming, right? There wasn't this shame toward this man. There was no embarrassment. He willingly unloosed his sandal and handed it off. And the way that this had evolved at this point of time in Ruth's time was that this was more like a business transaction. There was no shame in him not doing this. It was just, well, you know, okay, you're willing to do it. That's fine. I'll take off my sandal here and give it to you, showing the transaction is taken care of. We're all good. Everybody looks good. Okay, everybody's happy. Okay, we go on. That's the way it was in Ruth's time. And what's interesting is as we read this, the writer of Ruth, and we don't know exactly who it was that wrote Ruth, speaks to the audience who is reading this and says, now this was the manner in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and concerning changing. And so the way it was when the writer wrote the book of Ruth was not the way they handled it back in the day of Ruth. Now, I don't know with certainty, so I'm going to kind of make a conjecture here. But when you look at the way Israel progressed, the way that they kind of went, I kind of doubt they went back to the way that God said it should be done. They probably kind of devolved even more. Because we see that the nation of Israel didn't take a lot of things that God had said that were difficult, uncomfortable, inconvenient. They didn't take it very seriously, did they? Like the whole give the land a rest every so many years, the Sabbath rest for the land. They didn't take that very seriously. Like, oh, that's inconvenient. We don't want to disrupt our economy. We don't want to do all these things. You know, we're just going to kind of, you know, over time, these things kind of devolved. And we see that in our own culture, don't we? We see that over time. You look back and say, well, this is the way things used to be done. And we look back at that. But even when we look back at that time, that maybe is not the way it really should have been done or not the way it started out being done. And we see that this is a people who are just kind of loosening their standards, aren't they? They're kind of loosening their standards. We see this devolving going on when it comes to the things of the Lord, the way the Lord had set things up that's transpiring. But we also know that God, just because the culture changed, just because they adapted, God didn't change. God's standards didn't change. Not at all. In fact, even though the Israelites for years had given up on the land Sabbaths and all those things, when they went into captivity in Babylon, it was 70 years. And the Bible is very clear that is because they did not observe the land Sabbaths, and the Lord was going to make sure the land was going to get its rest. Because even though they changed and they adapted, God didn't change. And so there's a really important lesson for us when it comes to the things of the Lord, that where the Lord has spoken, where God has given us clarity and insight, it doesn't really matter what the culture does. God hasn't changed. And if we want to honor God, if we want to please God, we can't devolve with the culture. We have to be a place that holds to what the Lord has said and be committed to that. Even if we find that maybe we've slipped a little bit. Maybe we're like the people in the book of Ruth. Maybe we're not as bad as some that are going this way, but maybe we're not doing it the way that it was really prescribed to be done. Then we need to go back to what God wants, because God's not changing, right? God's not changing. And so Boaz, this transaction took place. He made all these statements in front of these 10 elders who he gathered. Verses 11 and 12, we see a blessing. We see in verse 11, and all the people that were in the gate and the elders, so it was a crowd had gathered, not just the 10 elders. They said, we are witnesses. The Lord make the woman that is come into thine house, which is Ruth, like Rachel and Leah, which too did build the house of Israel. And do thou worthily in Ephratah, and be famous in Bethlehem, and let thy house be like the house of Perez, who Tamar bare unto Judah, of the seed which the Lord shall give thee of this woman. Not only did they affirm the transaction, they blessed what had just happened. And they ask the Lord, they invoke the Lord to bless this transaction with specific blessings. They invoke the names of Rachel and Leah, who were the two women from whom the whole nation of Israel had came. That these, out of these two women, the whole nation of them came. And then also they invoke the name of Perez, who was Boaz's ancestor. But this was another story of redemption of a legacy through Tamar. And there's a whole other story associated with that. But it was another similar situation of a kinsman redeemer ultimately stepping in to raise up the name of one who had died. And the point was, God has shown that he could build a nation out of a little and redeem a name that otherwise would have been lost to time. And so they were praying for the Lord to provide that blessing upon this house and upon the children that Ruth would have or would hopefully have with Boaz. And sure enough, the Lord heard that blessing. That blessing had power to it because there was a good basis for the blessing. Kind of like a curse. People can curse you all day long, but the Bible says if there's no cause, the curse doesn't stick. But where there is a basis, a blessing can be a powerful thing. And so as they blessed these people, that blessing carried and had great power. And we'll see in verse 13 here, it says, "So Boaz took Ruth, and she was his wife. And when he went in unto her, the Lord gave her conception, and she bare a son. And the women said unto Naomi." Now these are the women that Naomi talked to when she first came to Bethlehem and said, "Call me Mara, call me bitter, because I've come back empty." These women now turn to Naomi and say, "Blessed be the Lord, which has not left thee this day without a kinsman, that his name," so they're blessing her, "that his name may be famous in Israel. And he shall be unto thee a restorer of thy life and a nourisher of thine old age for thy daughter-in-law, which loveth thee, which is better to thee than 7 sons has borne him." And Naomi took the child and laid it in her bosom and became nurse unto it. And the women, her neighbors, gave it a name, saying, "There is a son born to Naomi." And they called his name Obed. Here we see the Lord blessed this union. And Ruth had a son. And the blessing was not only to Ruth, but it was to Naomi. This woman who had came back and felt that she was beyond hope. Her life was empty. Her life was bitter. She could never feel joy again. Everything had been taken away from her. The Lord blessed. And there was this child born to Ruth, and Naomi became kind of like a surrogate mother and a nurse to this child. And Obed became, in a sense, the kinsman redeemer, because he was the one who would be raised up, who actually would take on the name of, the legacy of Elimelech and her children, so that it could be perpetuated forward into time. And it was Ruth's loyal love. Ruth's loyal love. It says in verse 15 that she loveth thee. Her loyal love, that Hebrew word hesed. They said, this loyal love of Ruth has provided more to you than your husband or sons ever could. More than 7 sons. And we see that Naomi wasn't bitter. She lived up to her name to be joyful, to be happy. And I don't believe that this removed the pain of the loss in the sense of her husband and her sons whom she loved. But the Lord grew her heart in such a way that she could feel joy again. And she could feel love again. And she could feel happiness again. Because the Lord grew her in such a way. And she was so blessed. And we see here that this son's name was Obed, which means servant. And we go on in verse 17 and it says, "And he is the father of Jesse, the father of David." And now it goes back to Perez. Remember, Perez was mentioned, the one whose name was redeemed. These are the generations of Perez. Perez begat Hezron. Hezron begat Ram. Ram begat Amminadab, and Amminadab begat Nashon, and Nashon begat Salmon, and Salmon begat Boaz, and Boaz begat Obed, and Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begat David. As we look at that arc, we see, if you're thinking about it from Ruth and Naomi's perspective and Boaz, all they saw was their little story. All they saw was their little life and those things the Lord did. I heard Brother Donald was talking about God moments today in Sunday school. And no doubt when they looked at their life and all these things, they saw God moments. They saw, not chance, but they saw the Lord. They saw God doing something in this and the redemption of that and able to have this child. And as far as they were concerned, the Lord had blessed them, had done such great things. But the writer of this book saw a bigger arc, that there was this lineage leading to David. David, who would be the king, or perhaps was the king of Israel when this was written. And this is telling some of the backstory on him for the people of the nation to know what God had done and to know about his Moabite lineage, which was no doubt probably kind of like, oh, he's got a Moabite in his history. And they're like, yeah, look at who that Moabite was. What a godly woman that she was. And to kind of help people understand that. So the writer of this is writing this, and he sees this arc that's leading to David. But what the writer didn't know that we can now appreciate is that God was seeing an even bigger arc, right? This arc that's going to lead us not just to David, but to the throne that was established of David, that Jesus Christ himself would be born of the lineage of David, the son of David, who would be upon that throne. And this is part of the arc of Jesus's earthly lineage. And even the writer didn't see that. And isn't it that way with us? That gives me a lot of hope. I mean, we just see this little thing, our little life. And just we read about this story about these two women and a guy and all that happened, and then a baby being born, and that seems like what a blessing. And this, you know, this is the end of the story, but it's not. And that's the beautiful thing about our lives. When our lives are given to the Lord and when we live our lives for the Lord, you know, we're going to see, the Lord's going to give us glimpses and bits, blessings right here in this place that are going to, it's going to make it worthwhile. But my friend, the half has not yet been told, and I can't wait to hear the rest of the story someday. What God can do if we would but yield ourselves to Him. The things he's trying to accomplish that we don't even see. Why Mr. So-and-so? What about him? What about him? He was committed to redeeming Elimelech's land when he thought it could advantage him, but he reneged on it when he saw that it could cost him. The Lord doesn't like it when we make a commitment and back out because it becomes hard. Psalm 15, verses 1 and 4, I've been thinking about this passage a bit lately. It says, O Lord, who shall sojourn in your tent? Who shall dwell on your holy hill? And it goes on and names different qualities. And one of those mentioned is one who swears to his own hurt and does not change. Meaning that when you make a commitment and you later find out that that commitment will cost you more than you anticipated, you hold true to your word because the Lord holds true to his word even when it costs him greatly. For this man, Mr. So-and-so, his idol was his land and his legacy. He wanted an enduring name for himself, for it to be passed on to his children. But Boaz was most concerned with Ruth and Naomi's welfare, and he was okay if Mr. So-and-so would redeem it. That would be okay. I mean, he desired to be the one to do it, but he would be okay if Mr. So-and-so do it because he was most concerned with doing things God's way. But Mr. So-and-so wouldn't do it, and so Boaz was there because ultimately it was not just about him, it was about them. This picture of love. And today, nobody knows Mr. So-and-so's name. That's why it says that in the Hebrew. It would not have been hard for someone to figure out who that was. They had all sorts of genealogical records and things like that at the time this was written. That would not have probably been very difficult. But I think the scripture is very purposeful in not telling us his name, because his name didn't matter. Not in the grand scheme of what God was accomplishing. Because this man sought to build a legacy. He was left with nothing. But Boaz wasn't seeking to build a legacy. He was seeking to love people, even when it cost him. And the Lord gave him a legacy. Jesus said in Matthew 10, "Whoever does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will lose it. And whoever loses his life for my sake will find it." I think this is a premium example of what we saw in Jesus Christ this morning. He was committed to doing things the Lord's way, his Father's way. Not of his own power, not of a shortcut, not what Satan offered him, because it was truly a sham. It wouldn't last. He was committed to do what the Father wanted, even if it cost him. And to him has been given a name that is above all names, right? And Boaz, this man who was willing to impair his inheritance or anything else to take care of these women, his name is enshrined in Scripture, and he has an eternal legacy as part of the earthly lineage of Jesus Christ. I don't know how it's all going to work out, folks. I don't know what God's asking of you, requiring of you. I don't know what it's going to cost. But I know that if we trust the Lord and do what He would ask us to do, whatever we do for Him, through Him, it's going to last. It's going to matter. It makes our life worth living. And there are so many other lessons we could gather from the book of Ruth here. I mean, it's a picture of a kinsman redeemer, one who was near enough, close enough to be able to redeem one who was helpless. And that's a picture of Jesus, isn't it? Who came down from heaven, who took on human flesh so that he could be the sacrifice for our sin. We see in the book of Ruth a picture of the grafting in of the Gentiles into the covenant community of the people of God, which is why we're all here today, right? There's a picture of that. It's an example of covenant love that seizes us and will not let us go. If you're one of the Lord's, that He won't let you go no matter what, just like He wouldn't let Naomi go. There's so many pictures there, and we've just scratched the surface. But I hope in all these things that the lessons and the points here that, you know, it's kind of like a shotgun when you go through a narrative like this. There's all sorts of things, and whatever the Lord wants to lodge in your heart, I hope it sticks. I hope it sticks. I hope you let it work and do whatever the Lord is trying to build in you and encourage in you or to purge out of you. Because that's the point. It's not just to hear a beautiful story. It's to draw nearer to the Lord. To be more of who He's called us to be His people, for Him to be our God, that we might be more like our kinsman redeemer, Jesus Christ, that we would have that willingness to lay our lives down. Don't know how it's all going to work out. I don't have it all figured out. But whatever we do for the Lord, through the Lord, will make our life matter and will make it last. And what a blessing. What a blessing you have as a child of God to have the ability and the potential to live a life that eternally matters. There are people who are born and who die on this world all the time that don't know Christ, and their life has been wasted. Their life has been wasted. No matter how much they've gained, it's just been wasted. But it doesn't have to be that way for any of us through Christ. There are so many blessings to being a child of God. We cannot even begin to fathom how blessed we are. Let's have a song this evening. Let's stand and sing and honor the Lord. If the Lord's put something on your heart this evening, let's be obedient to Him.